Happy New Year, everybody. Welcome back to the Brenton on Tour podcast, the first edition for 2020. We continue the music series. Dave Palmer, drummer extraordinaire from Rod Stewart and many, many others, which you'll learn. His tour manager, Ben Melman. What's it like tour managing a guy like Dave and Kevin and some of these people that have been playing with Rod forever, have been touring the world for 25, 30 years and beyond. So we're going to get into that. Dave's going to tell us a bit about his history growing up in the UK, some of the bands he played with. It's a great story. We did it in Liverpool, you know, home of the Beatles. So it just seemed appropriate and perfect to get into it. Thanks for all of your help in 2019, liking and sharing. We peaked at number 3 on Apple for People and Places. So I like being in the top 10, and it's all thanks to you. So thanks for your help. Brought to you by my friends at Varia Brewing. It's a 3-in-1 coffee maker. I've got one just sent to me. I'm testing it out this week, and then I'm going to send you, you know, one in the mail. So like, share, do what you do. Let's get it out there, friends. The Brenton on Tour podcast has returned with Dave Palmer and Ben Melman. Here we go.
Let's rock. Let's rock today.
Out on stage, I get to bring all of these people together for 3 hours.
You're listening to the Brenton on Tour Music Cast, brought to you by people who love music, people who make music, and all things, well, music. You still don't really know who he is, but he just helped you stop drinking shitty coffee on the Coffee Cast. So, get off the John, grab a ghetto blaster, hit record and play at the same time, and learn a thing or two about music. It's the Brenton on Tour Music Cast. Here's BD.
I am joined in Liverpool with the very awesome Dave Palmer. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing good. Brent. Yeah, I'm really pretty happy. Yeah, we are in the Titanic Hotel, you know? Yeah, which is pretty cool. Yeah.
The Titanic was built here. There's sort of like it was built here and then it was shipped away.
Yeah, and then shipped to Belfast, I think. It was like, it seems like it was all put together here, I think, you know?
We're also joined by your tour manager, Mr. Yeah. Ben Melman. How you doing, sir?
Great. Excited to be here.
Yeah, we're just hanging out. We're going to have a little drum and touring and touring in 2019 chat. And I thank you gentlemen both for your time. The music cast is into the new year. It's 2020. And the world of touring has changed over the last couple of years. I've had the benefit of being out with some great musicians, players, tour managers over the last couple of years. So I want to touch on a whole bunch of different things, a bit of history, Dave, with Rod Stewart and in England. And Ben, I thought I'd bring you in as a co-host here because you've been with Dave for a long time and we can talk a little bit about the history of touring with this band, how much fun it's been for you and all the rest of it, and a bit of where you think touring's going in 2020 and beyond. So here we are. Yeah. We're just kind of hanging out. We're going to have a little chat. So let's get that for our listeners around the world. And here we are. Give us a little lowdown of Dave Palmer. He grew up, 60 miles from here? Where?
Yes. Chesterfield, Derbyshire. I'm a Derby guy. I suppose my musical history started in 1981, 82. I joined this band called ABC. And we had an album out called Lexicon of Love, what was produced by Trevor Horn, and it had a couple of big singles on it, Poison Arrow, Look of Love, and stuff like that. And we kind of, so that started me. I was 17 and a half when I joined that band, and that started me on my professional career. I ended up touring America in 1983, and it was, you know, amazing. And then after that, I kind of came back and ended up doing some touring in Japan with the Yellow Magic Orchestra and Ryuichi Sakamoto and people like that. In 85, I ended up doing work with Paul Young and, you know, Pino Palladino got me that gig. I ended up touring with him for 2 years. We supported Genesis on their big tour, and that was a great tour. And then
Which tour? That was 85, Genesis?
It was the big 80. We played Giant Stadium and all the big. So it was the big stadium tour. It was the Invisible Touch tour, that one, you know, that bit. You know, it was pretty impressive, actually. I'd never seen I mean, I'd never played to that amount of people before. I mean, it was 75,000 people every night they were playing to, you know.
You were playing with Paul then?
We were supporting them. So
Paul
Young was supporting them. And so unfortunately, as the people were walking in, we were playing, you know, and it was still light when we were hitting the stage, you know. But it was a great tour. And then I ended up joining this band called the Matt Johnson. And I did four records with Matt from 86 to really 93. I did most of his albums. I was on tour with the and we were playing Ross Gilder. And I get a call in the production office. And it's a call from... Bernard Edwards from Chic, and he was producing Rod's new record. He'd just done Out of Order with him, so it was Andy Taylor, and I'd done a lot of work with Andy, and Bernard was producing. I'd done a lot of Andy's solo albums, and he says, look, Rod's looking for a drummer, and this is obviously before cell phones. This is like 1990, you know, it's like there's no cell phones, or 1990, and so, you know, it's like I get a call, and he says, hey, when can you get out here? And I'm going, where? He goes, L.A., He goes, he's looking for a drummer. I said, well, I can't. The tour finishes in 3 weeks. He goes, oh, well, get your ass out of here then. And I kind of bought a plane ticket and came out to LA. And I did an audition at Cherokee Studios on Fairfax. So I came in and Rod, all the musicians were all set up there, you know, and I walked in. And I think Rod showed up. I walked in about 12 o'clock. Rod showed up at about 4. We played about 3 or 4 songs. Then we went over to this place called Genghis Cohen and just got completely hammered. And then right at the end of the night, he goes, hey, you know, you've got the gig, you know. So that was my audition. And it was kind of like the rest has been history, really. So I've been here really since 1990, you know.
Rod was coming out of some pretty big songs out of the 80s.
Yeah, he was coming out of those big records. It was the Out of Order record, the Forever Young, Lost in You, you know, it was that right after that. And I did the follow-up record to that, which was called Vagabond Heart. And that's how I started. So I started playing with him, recording with him, then obviously touring.
The scene around here, Derbyshire, like growing up,
yeah,
and coming through with ABC, what's the exposure like? How are you breaking? Are you breaking on radio?
Yeah,
videos were kind of a thing then.
Yeah.
I mean, Ben, you guys had MTV in America and all the rest of it, and that's where we would have saw in Canada. We had Much Music. Is that where you got your videos from in America? How did you find music back then?
Well, I was of the generation where I was really being introduced to music. I was too young for music videos on MTV, and all the music was really coming from terrestrial radio, and blogs were becoming a thing. And what were the most popular tracks being downloaded on Napster and LimeWire was really where it started, you know, where I found my music, and then the power of iTunes.
So then you take it back to how you guys have to break it or have break through. How does one come through? How does one break through?
We were
back then. What year is this? This is
the plan. Plan at that time for most acts in the early 80s was that you recorded a record, or you went in and you recorded three singles. So ABC, what we did is we went in and we recorded the first single first, and then released it. And then all of a sudden it's like, fuck, oh, now we've got to do a record. You know, now we've got to get the record together, because the single really took off, and it kind of like it surprised everybody at how well it did. So we released three singles in England, then came the album. In America, it was just the album, you know, which got released, which we were on Phonogram in England, and we were on Polygram in America. America just released the record. So we just did a tour on the back of the record, you know?
And that's got to be, you got to do that with a video. You got to get on.
We did our first video with Julian Temple, who did the great Rock and Roll Swindle. He did the great, he did that amazing documentary on Joe Strummer as well, which is really worth watching. And yeah, he did our first video.
What was the difference between the demand here in the UK compared to the States? You know, was the difference enormous?
Yeah, I would say in Europe in general. I know that the album outsold definitely here and Europe than America. I mean, the album was made to look like it was selling like insane amounts, but in actual fact, I think someone said that we only actually sold, I think, this is 80s as well. I think we sold only 300,000 albums.
Well, is a lot. And you know how many bands would kill to sell 10% of that now?
Yeah. Yeah. We sold, I think the album went 3 million in Europe alone. 3 million album records were sold. So it was very, very big, very popular in Europe, you know. America, we found out they couldn't, because it was so okay. This is what we found out: it wasn't rock, so it wasn't played on a rock station. But what it was played on was believe it or not, R&B, black R&B stations. So we did Soul Train. We played. We appealed to more that sort of crowd, or that kind of, you know, and it became apparent, trust me, when we started, we toured, you know, we played LA, we played Chicago, we played Miami, and we played all those places. Then we played Austin, Texas. And it was like, wait a second, why are we going on before? What's this other band? And we found out we were a support band for like some covers, Van Halen or something like that band. I mean, that's how small we were in those places. But we did the gig, but it wasn't, it was like, it was, you know, we weren't that popular in, you know.
How does a Van Halen cover band treat ABC from the UK, and you guys walk in and you're like, what do you mean they sold 300,000 records?
Yeah, check this out. It was a 16-piece band. We had a 6-piece orchestra with us as well. We had a string section. It was like insane. I mean, it was unbelievable.
What was your gig in Austin?
It was like this small club, but all I remember was chicken wire being around the stage. And I'm going, what is that chicken wire for? And it's because it's to stop, they throw shit at you if you're not good, you know? They had a fucking chicken wire around the stage. I kid you not.
So you have your current tour manager, Ben, here. We're hanging out in Liverpool. It's the day off. We're chilling. Everyone's recovering from being sick. Define the role of the tour manager then.
Yeah.
When you've sold 300,000 records, you're touring all these people around the world. You got an orchestra, and then you go in and you do a gig with the chicken wire, and it's small, and you're open, and there's like a Van Halen cover band. Versus what you think Ben has to go through now. Because there's a drastic difference between the two.
I would refuse to have done it back then without technology and hearing stories from Dave's past. That count me out.
That's when they sent Ravens to send your rider.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Anyway, so, you know, obviously you've had many tour managers over the years, but like, are you like, oh, you're so lucky, Ben. You know, what's it like back then?
Oh, it's
the circus or what?
No, it was a circus, but it was also, what is it like now? I'm trying to think. It's a lot more chilled out. No, that's what I will say. Yeah, today it's a lot more relaxed, and it seems to be, I don't know, the general attitude. I mean, at that time, you know, the 80s and the 90s, it seemed to be, there was an abundance, you know, there was a lot more, there was a lot more openings, and you could do more. There was a lot more potential as well, you know, to actually do stuff. Where today, it's like, you know, I actually feel sorry for a lot of up and coming musicians, where, you know, you can see that that's not going to be their main source of income. they're going to have to, hey, if you want to play a, if you want to play an instrument, you may have to go out and find a second job. You know, you may have to, and it's, you know, it's.
And that's probably, I would say, realistic for almost everybody in the business. I mean, everyone was pretty busy, busy then, touring all the time. And, you know, now everyone's got to have four gigs. You know, a lot of guys, specialized guys can do their thing. But, I mean, Ben, you're working on lots of stuff. You're tour managing this, but, you know, you're also doing your thing on the side. Like, I mean, how are, you know, are you consistently... You know, you're looking at your sched and you're filling. What's the role of the new tour manager going through right now with that?
Yeah, I mean, I can really only speak to for myself and, you know, what we have to deal with here on Rod Stewart. But there's 13 or 12 band members in this band, and we're on a totally different schedule than the than Rod and the crew. So I think most of these band members have been doing this for a while and, you know, come from the rock and roll era where now they're kind of... You know, they're just, they're still enjoying what they're doing, but it's not as, what's the word I'm looking for? They're not, you guys clearly aren't partying as hard as you used to. And,
No.
But you're still loving every minute of it.
Yeah.
I think for me, the role of the tour manager, at least on this gig, is really being capable of using the internet to our power.
Yeah. You
know, everybody, I'd say about half the band has gotten the flu within the last week. And finding different doctors in different cities all really comes down to your capabilities of quickly finding doctors in different cities through the internet, or using Google Maps to our advantage and using TripAdvisor and all these different websites to try and find different hotels within our budget that really aren't on the beaten path but might have the potential to be the new hotels that we always stay at when we're in Liverpool or when we're in Munich. So I think obviously keeping everybody up to speed with what's going on and making sure that our movements are as efficient as possible to get everybody the most amount of rest, because we are on a decently rigorous schedule.
You know, you've got your own personal, that I don't want to say agenda when you're touring, but there is like, how are you, you know, one of the things I'm trying to focus on this particular part of the music cast is how we're staying fit on tour. So it's changed from... You know, that first time you went out on tour of like, let's just lose our minds and let's go and have some fun.
Yeah.
But we're moving into an era now where bands are doing full workout regimes. Bands are doing all the rest of it. What's a Dave Palmer must have to have you function through and push through to be able to do these shows, get through the flu, still play sick, do the rest of it. But how you, what's your plan to stay fit out here?
Okay. So, when I'm at home, I work out three times a week with the three of my friends. One of my friends is an actor, and many years ago, he studied for a part to be an SAS guy. So he actually went and did the full SAS training with what they do. So what we do, we drive to I live in LA. We drive to UCLA. To the Royce grounds at about 6 a.m. We run a mile. Then we do 10 sets, 5 chin-ups, 15 push-ups, 20 air squats, 10 times. Then we run another mile after that around the track. That's 4 times around the track. Or we'll run the bleachers. Up and down the bleachers, and that's my regime there. My regime when I'm on the road is the same deal: is to run a mile and then just do a minor workout. At the moment, I'm not been doing that because I've been under the. I'm one of the flu guys. I'm kicking the flu, and I've had it for the last sort of 4 or 5 days. So I'm just taking it easy. And today I'm gonna go to the steam room and try and clean my sinuses out. But I think cardio is really important when you're out on the road. And also, you're right. The days of waking up, or you know, and feeling like, oh man, under the weather, or you know, like hungover. And shit like that. They're, you know, I've read that book. You know, I've worn the T-shirt.
You've written that book.
I've written that. Yeah, I've rented the DVD. I've rented the DVD. You know, I know how that film plays out. You know, from right to the end. You know, beginning to end.
It was mandatory for Ben to read that book before he came out.
Yeah,
on everybody. Everyone, send your book.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Thank God I'm out of women's clothing. That is for sure.
Speaking of styling,
sorry about that.
Yeah, now we, just for the record, it is now December the 9th, and Ben and I just got the flu. We just got the flu from Dave. So
Dave insisted on taking this podcast to his room, the flu ingested room.
But hey, good thing we're working out on tour, Ben, because here we are.
Hey, is it feeling swampy?
It feels great in here.
Oh, okay, good. Okay, cool.
Style-wise, so you're talking about that. So you're still a stylish guy, Dave. Are you still wearing the same clothes from back then?
Yeah.
What was happening, you know, from the 80s to now, you got a little bit of a new look? Because I saw some of those videos, and it's looking good.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, you're right. Actually, you're right. Yeah, ABC wore suits, and, you know, it's, but we did wear gold lame suits. And I was quite happy after that tour finished to take it outside and throw it in a trash can and burn it, you know? Tin foil, you know? It was like, gold lame suits, yeah.
Where's is there a spot for you? And I like to ask this of anybody and this is for you too, Ben, which you're still working towards your journey, your tour managing, and you're going to keep achieving things. And Dave, I think we all just keep achieving. If we're in it long enough, we keep going after new things, right? I wanted to do Wembley. I got Wembley. I wanted to do, you know, to go to this city. I've been to that city. There's just these little tiny things that we set out for. Where was the moment for you where you said, there it is. I'm making it. I don't like using that term making it, but where was that moment for you where you'd put the hard work in and either your calendar's so jammed you can't do anything else. You're so in demand that everyone, you know, you can't keep up to it, or you just feel like you've entered that level of respect where pretty much you're set for the rest of your life now. Yeah. Outside of selling 300,000 records and actually, you know, being able to make money on record sales, it's more like, when were you the most comfortable in your own skin through that journey? You know,
I think possibly for me was, I think it was when I'd gotten back from Japan, I think, for the first time, and then I started doing sessions for people like Steve Lillywhite and people in London were starting to, because obviously they'd heard me play on Lexicon of Love, and, you know, and it was like, and I'd started getting, being booked for, you know, hey, for me as a player. You know, hey, let's get David in, you know, and I wasn't living in London at the time. I was still living at that time in Sheffield. So I'd get on the train and go down there and do sessions for people. And I suppose that's when it started feeling, when I started working with the as well. And, you know, I think the album Mind Bomb was a real turning point for me. When people heard Mind Bomb, it kind of fucking blew their minds, you know. People hadn't heard shit like that before, you know, and it was like people were always... I mean, I have drummers come up to me even now and go, hey, man, you know, we studied that record at Berklee, you know, School of Music, you know. It's like the album, you know, and that's a real... One of my friends, actually, Stacey Jones, he's Miley Cyrus's musical director. And he's also a terrific drummer. Him and Abel Boreal Jr., they both studied that album. You know, it's one of their favorite records. You know, so it's like, that's a compliment. And that's when I feel like, as far as creativity was concerned, I think that period of the you know, 90s and into the 2000s was just like a really wild period, because people were just getting into electronics, man. We were just finding, you know, there were samples. We were using drum samples on that album, on Mind Bomb. So the drums were all bolstered with drum samples, but they didn't have samplers, so they were using AMSs or primitive real machines, but you know, it's kind of cool. So I think that's when music started really changing, around that period. Sounds were different, you were hearing different things, you were hearing technology was kicking in, you know, Frankie Goes to Hollywood was kicking in, and bands like that, when you were going, whoa, you know, a New Order were doing, you know, stuff which was completely unique and very electronic, you know, and hybrid, you know.
What were you listening to then? Are you a fan? Were you more of a modern? Were you a modern?
Yeah.
Are you a modern music fan now?
Yeah, I was listening, but I would also listen a lot. I'd listen a lot to all sorts of stuff: jazz, pop, rock. You know, it's really weird for me. The bands, what I listened to around that time, I'm trying to think, was obviously contemporary stuff Massive Attack was a huge influence around that time as well. When they came out, they just turned it up. The Bristol scene turned the thing upside down, you know. So there was movements in England. There was like these collectives and movements. Massive Attack was really a big part of the, you know, that, you know, you got that, and then you've got, like, you know, then of course all the music from America as well. There's some great music coming out of America. Or was there? I'm not sure.
That one. Yeah. People would debate that.
Yeah,
people would debate any time frame. Everyone thinks they grew up in the best time of music.
Definitely think that when Nirvana kicked in 1993, that was a movement. That was a change. That was like it was needed. It was much needed.
It's amazing when those moments, moments kind of hit.
It was something real. You know, it's, I think it's good when things come out and it's reactionary, because it's you know, against, they were the antithesis of corporate rock, and I think music was getting very corporate at that time, you know, and the corporations were really starting to take over, and I think they were kind of all, I think the kind of Seattle scene just turned out upside down. Sub Pop kind of was the big, you know.
Ben, you came through sort of your world a bit sort of after that. Were you influenced, you know, what's your kind of favorite music that you're listening to at that time, or what's bringing you through your journey to becoming a tour manager? Because we all kind of start in music, right? Like, I started in music. Dave, I talked to you a bit earlier about Dimebag Darrell from Pantera, and sort of like, I just did an episode on him, his tragic passing, but just sort of like how important that time in music played in my journey, you know, out of the 80s into the 90s, and sort of like the different changes in music. Ben, so as Dave has sort of walked through his, you know, journey through America and some of these different bands out of the UK that were influencing him, does the same thing apply to you? Do you start somewhere? Is there a band for you where you're like, oh, wait a minute, and then you decide I'm doing it because of this kind of thing?
Doing it just kind of fell in place. The first music that I was really introduced to was, my mom was a big Dixie Chicks and Luther Vandross fan. You know, two totally opposite ends of the spectrum. But that's what was always in the car when I was getting picked up to go to school or getting dropped off. You know, that's what we were listening to. And there was a few other records in there, of course. But it was the first real record that I remember kind of picking on my own beyond the Beach Boys and everything that my parents were listening to when I must have been 10 or 11 was The Real Slim Shady by Eminem when I was living in Seattle. We were living in Seattle for, my mom was having cancer treatment, so we were living in a hotel. And anything that had a parental advisory sticker on it or rated R was definitely not, I was not allowed to listen to it. But the hotel receptionist, it's funny, I spent 8 months in a hotel that year, and now I'm doing it again, being a tour manager. But the receptionist in the lobby used to rip me CDs, and the first CD I had was The Real Slim Shady. So it kind of opened up this, well, kind of, I guess, a rebel in me. And I was always playing instruments, but I really started getting into urban music and hip hop. And then fast forward a few years later, I'm buying Tupac records and really just very fascinated by hip hop music while still listening to everything else.
And Eminem started a movement just on his own too. I mean, coming out of that moment of hip hop needed a change as well.
Yeah. And it was insane.
And did you guys get much of hip hop over here?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I loved it. I was living in America when he came out. That was the thing. I'd already moved. I'd moved to New York 91. So I was already in America when he started hitting, you know, hard. So he was like great. I've got to tell you, there was one night we were at, a club. I'm trying to think of the name of it now. It was off the West Side Highway, and it used to be a roller skating rink. And then they'd close it and they'd open it up as a club. What was it called? I'm trying to think of it. But every Wednesday night, they had this night. And I was there one night with Arthur Baker and Nile Rodgers and a bunch of other people, and we're all hanging. And Nirvana, the DJ was playing Nirvana. And then right after Nirvana, there was like this, freak out. Ding, 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 ding. And man, the Nile Rodgers turned around. He says, now this is a good record. But what I'm trying to say is the two genres, actually, music's, if it's good music, if it's fucking good music, it kicks. It jumps out of the speakers at you. And the Nirvana track was amazing. And then the Chic track was amazing. And this guy, this DJ, would mix rock. Then he'd play the Clash, Rock the Casbah. And then he'd play something, he'd play another heavy track, you know. And it's like, music's, it's amazing. It has, you know, the genres and stuff are just...
I think that part, not that I'm going to clubs anymore. The last time you went to a club, Ben, but I don't see that crossover happening right now.
No.
The kids are kind of liking everything, but they don't know what they like.
Yeah.
Like they're sort of like, you know, I guess it's healthy from the standpoint of everyone's got kind of everything on their phone or on their iPhone or whatever. When I was kind of coming through, it wasn't as collective. Like you were sort of a metal and rock fan. You weren't like a Depeche Mode and New Order fan, even though they're all considered rock sort of now. There was a bit more of a time. I just find that it's to that point, it's like you can go to that club and have those genres mix and everyone still loses their mind because it's a good song. I'm wondering if that is the case now. Is it hip for a, like, you know, Billie Eilish just admitted she doesn't know who Van Halen is and everyone's freaking out about it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why would she know who Van Halen is?
How old is she?
She's 17 like, years old. Right? Like, why would she know? And she's not going to stand there and when they put on Ain't Talking About Love in a club and she's going to like, you know, jump up and down and be all excited to hear Van Halen. Yeah, it's just not going to happen.
Absolutely.
And
Billie doesn't seem like the type of person we'd find in a nightclub anyways.
No, but I'm talking, but it's just like, it's just there's a bit of like thing happening now where crossover is not happening as much.
I actually, to be perfectly honest with you, I found her music really refreshing. I listened to her albums and her album, sorry, and I was like freaked out. I loved it. I liked it because it was it's sparse, it's really bare, it's really minimal. But it's super effective, and all you do is you just focus on her voice and the sound of her voice and how interesting it is. And I think the combination of her and her brother, I think that's a pretty you know.
And he's getting some great gigs out of it now too.
Yeah,
you know, he's
producing
a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
I did her first two shows in Philly. I had her when she was the first gig. We sold 500 tickets to. It sold out instantaneously. And then the second gig, she did 1,000 tickets and sold out instantaneously. And her brother was in the band for both of those shows. Her mother was pretty much playing the role as the road manager.
Yeah.
And her father was the LD. It was pretty incredible.
Yeah.
And I think they're still pretty actively involved.
So, we're winding down. So I know you're recovering from sickness, so I won't keep you too much longer. So.
Yeah.
One of the things that I wanted to touch on was sort of just, you know, that journey through the process. And now you've been playing with Rod since 1990, been Rod's guy. Any work that you're most proudest of? I mean, outside of what you touched on with Dada and selling and like anything that you're composing music now too. You're doing some film work and the rest of it. Are you in a great creative zone right now? Are you feeling like you're top of your game?
I am. I'm feeling. I'm actually looking forward to next year. You know, I'm actually looking forward to this. We have a little bit of forced downtime, which is nice. Me and my wife have just moved home. So we moved in on Tuesday as I left on the following Monday. So, I mean, I'm looking forward to kind of getting back there and building a studio and getting everything kind of working and having, you know, and recording and doing. I've got a lot of friends who are editors and music editors and film editors and I'm going to try and get more. I'd really like to try and get more into doing some TV stuff or even film stuff, you know, placements and things like that. That's what I'd like to do next year. That's going to be my main focus at the beginning of the year, really, you know.
Very cool. Okay, last question for you both. David, best part of touring, worst part of touring, and where do you think touring is going in 2020 and beyond? I know it's three parts, but
okay. I'll do the best part of touring and worst part of touring first. Best part of touring is I love the playing. I love the 2 hours each night. You know, I love the. It's when you get in that zone. It's safe. It's a safe place. You know, and it's like it's almost like. You kind of forget where you're at, you know. It's great, and I love visiting. I love being able to visit interesting places and cities, and I feel really blessed to be, you know, to be able to do this. You know, it's quite a charmed life, you know, I feel. I'm pretty humbled by it all, you know, and that's the way I've always been, you know. I don't take anything for granted, you know. Worst part about touring is I get slightly homesick these days. I miss my daughter, you know. I miss my wife, you know. I get slightly homesick, you know, that's pretty much it. That's the only downside of it, really, I can say. You know, it's a job what I chose to do. You know, it's a fantastic job. Now, what was the third?
Where do you see touring going in 2020 and beyond? Yeah. Because a lot of bands are trying to be green and a lot of bands are trying to, like, tidy it up and try to do stuff. So, I mean, touring is kind of on autopilot for the most part if you got a great tour manager and production managers and stuff that keep it rolling. But do you see a change for the artists?
Yeah, I do. I see a change. There's been a big change, I think, in the artist. And I think, actually, you must see it, and Ben must see it even more, is that I think if you put a great package together these days of a two or a three or a co-headline, you've got a very good possibility of it being a good sellout tour. I think the idea these days and the fallacy that you can go out there, unless you are a really hot, you know, top 20, top 10 even, is. But hey, you know what? I know that there was times when Rihanna and people like that, she was like selling mega amounts of her albums and couldn't sell an arena out, you know, she'd have to have people, you know, with it. And that's no disrespect to her. It's just the way it is. I think that it's very, very, that's very different now. I think and I suppose it's ticket prices as well, maybe, and, you know, not the abundance anymore, you know.
To touch on Dave's point, you know, with, the way that touring used to be is as a consumer, they would have to pick whether, you know, how much money they're willing to invest into the music economy. Can they afford to buy an album and a ticket? And now that streaming has dramatically reduced how much disposable income is being spent on hard copy albums, you know, does that create more opportunity for fans to buy more tickets?
Yeah.
And then we have seen the ticket prices increasing over the last, I don't know how many years. So I think that's what I'm most fascinated about in the future is where is technology and where are these kind of up and coming players going to take the future of touring? What as it, you know, when it comes to can you reduce ticket prices at all using different technologies, or can you make touring more efficient or more green or more practical so that there's more money to be, you know, made for artists, and instead of them getting price gouged, and maybe that drops the ticket price for consumers a little bit. So that's where I'm excited to see what happens.
And there is a movement to take things in a greener direction, less fuel. Yeah. So that's a whole other thing that's coming, and that's going to be a challenge in trying to figure out how to do that properly. Sustainability, keeping people like, you know, engaged, especially with the way the culture is now of people complaining about every single thing. Yeah. You go, you can go on a fully green tour and someone's going to find a way to complain. So, you know, I think you touched on a point earlier about, you know, giving people a great show, quality, great music.
Yeah.
There is this assumption that you can just go out on tour and you're just going to make all the money and go. But I still think that you need to back it up with a great product and you still need to back it up with great tunes, which is why Billy's selling out everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and some of these acts are either struggling that might have millions and millions of Spotify hits, but can't sell a record. You still got to have good quality.
Yeah.
And so it's going to be interesting to see where it goes. Ben, you're still in the phase of being on tour right now. So it's probably a little fresh for you from a tour management standpoint, but your best and worst of your gig.
The best is definitely, you know, making these lifelong friendships and relationships with people like you guys and the rest of the band and some of the crew members that, you know, I've become very close with. And same with Dave. Being away from home is probably the hardest part. I've seen a couple different areas of the music business now, and definitely being on the road has been the most rewarding and most fulfilling. There's nothing like it. So I guess the hardest part is being away from home.
Well, you touched on it there where you said, you know, making lifelong friendships and meeting people around the world. And I truly think when you spend the amount of time that we all spend together, you become a family, whether you like it or not. You become, you know, there's going to be, you know, some angers. There's going to be some whatever. Yeah, you're all going to go through with brothers and sisters and people do on the tour. But I think that we, the one thing that brings us together is music, and we all can connect on that. So you guys coming and helping me with the podcast, I really appreciate it. It's it's something creative for me. This is my drum solo every night, every week, and trying to figure out how to, you know, how to create something every single week. But I want to educate people a bit on
totally
what we on what we do and how we're trying to get out there. So hopefully we can do this again down the road, you know, and around episode 100 or something, and we'll get updates on everybody. Yeah. And Ben, I know you're working on something extremely exciting. I can't wait to break out and talk about, but we'll leave it in the can for now. For you listeners, you're just going to have to stand by until it comes out.
Exactly. I kind of know about it. It's exciting, man.
It's a bit exciting. Well, you're the godfather, right? You're the dawn of this. You're watching this, you know. That's right. He's going from there. So, I'll let you get to it. You go get some rest.
Go run some
steps first. And Ben, you go. You already did the gym, so I think you're covered on this sickness. Appreciate your time, gentlemen, and we'll see you on stage.
Thank you.
All right, boys. Take care.
You can always get more music talk with me, Todd Hancock, and the Toddcast podcast. We're on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, and in our latest podcast, we look back at 2019. You'll hear highlights from conversations with Steel Panther drummer Stick Zedinia, Corey, I Wear My Sunglasses at Night Heart, Hailstorm singer Lizzie Hale, Godsmack singer Sully Erna, The Ramones' CJ Ramone, Todd Kearns, and a bunch more like Nickelback singer Chad Kruger. Here he talks about songwriting and if it gets easier over the years.
Well, now because we've got 9 albums under the belt, we have to be incredibly cognizant of not sounding like something else we've done, but still sounding like us.
The Brenton on Tour Music Cast is brought to you by the Toddcast Podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Find everything at Toddcast Podcast. And you can hear the podcast, full interviews, and a bunch more through toddhancock.ca. We'll see you soon.
Hi, I'm Mercedes Nickel, four-time Winter Olympian and host of Dropping In, a podcast with Mercedes. This is a podcast where I interview a bunch of different people. I get the good, the bad, and the ugly, as well as I share my stories along the way. Now you can drop in at droppingin.com or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube. I'll see you soon.
Kids. I'm your eager beaver.
And I'm Mr. Grizzly.
If you love politics
or hate politics,
then have we the perfect podcast for you.
The True North Eager Beaver.
Incisive political commentary.
We keep you up to date
and give you the political and media literacy you seek
to help you
cut through the bovine fecal matter.
Facts first.
Sound analysis.
Sometimes I growl.
Sometimes I sass.
We impart civics and build community.
And we share some laughs along the way.
Being informed
and engaged has never been more fabulous.
Or sexy.
Catch us on the Dean Blundell Network.
Or on our YouTube channel.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
Because democracy is something you do.